ਤਾਂ ਕਮੂ ਵਿਚਾਰ ਭੇਦਾ ਜਾ ਕੋ ਭੇਦ ਨ ਪਾਵਕਰੀ ਮਹਾਂਤ ਮਹਾਂਮੂਰਤੀ ਨਜਾਂਤ ਮਹਾਂਦੇਵ ਕੋ ਕੈ ਸਦਾ ਸ਼ਿਵ।
A priest at the Sikh temple in Olathe chants hymns in Punjabi while stirring the ingredients of Kara Prashad, a holy bread. Once the bread is finished, it's served ceremonially in the presence of the Holy Scripture. This is a long-standing tradition for the followers of this ancient Indian religion. But the baking of Kara Prashad is just one example of how Kansas Cityans find meaning in ritual. Across faiths, people are out there doing things that their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents did before them, but the meaning they attach to those practices may be changing. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're asking what ancient rituals mean to millennials, whether it's covering your eyes while lighting candles on Shabbat, burning incense and attending Latin Mass, or baking and serving Kara Prashad. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Molly Hess is here with us from Tribe KC, where her job is Millennial Concierge. Molly, what is a Millennial Concierge and why does such a thing exist?
So basically, my job is to work one-on-one with young adults to help connect them to the Jewish community in the way they say most fit for themselves. So I call it intentional Jewish living, right? So this is needed because as our generations have changed, people are no longer flocking to synagogue life for their Jewish connection. They're finding it in their communities where they live, in the food that they eat. And so it's my job to help connect those people to each other.
What's your relationship with religion?
So I grew up a Reform Jew. So there's many different sects of Judaism. And I grew up in the Reform sect. So went through day school, religious school, summer camps, and was highly involved in Judaism. And then when I got to college, I sort of felt like I've had enough. And as an adult, have been trying to find my way back to the religion.
Do you find meaning as you're trying to find your way back? I mean, I'm curious. It seems like the way back to something that you came from shouldn't be so hard. What makes it hard to find your way back?
So what makes it hard is, I think, finding your community and finding your place. And so the longer I've been in Kansas City, the more I found my people and the more I find my place. And as I work in this job, I'm really finding people that I connect with. And to me, that's the deepest connection to Judaism is through people and community.
What about ritual? I mean, do you find meaning in carrying out the rituals you grew up with, even though at some point you felt you'd largely had enough?
Yeah. So for me, the deepest ritual that I can connect to is Shabbat. So Friday night, though I don't do it on the regular basis, every time I do, it feels like, yes, this is right. Like, this is what I should be doing. This is my way to separate the week and start anew and be able to start the next week.
Can you describe what doing a Shabbat dinner is like for people who haven't been a part of one?
Sure. So in my house, I try to cook traditional Jewish food if I can, or make it out of other things, like buying a roast chicken pre-made since I don't have time. But so cooking traditional Jewish foods, and then I always like to do the blessing. So blessing over the challah, over
which
is a traditional Jewish bread, the candles, and wine. Wine is a very important part in my home. So for me, and it's bringing people together. So bringing friends and Jewish and non-Jewish, all walks of life, into my home for a meal with the purpose of separating the week. And so that's what the ritual looks like in my house. For other people, it means a lot of different things. For my sister, she completely shuts down her phone from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday and disconnects from the world and sort of has a day of meditation. So for everyone, it's different.
Do you attach it to its sort of theological underpinnings very strongly? I mean, is it part of a thou shalt kind of situation for you? Or is it more about this practice of, in your own personal life, separating weekend from weekday?
For me, it doesn't go back to the theology. But what it does do is I think about the generations before me. And I also think about everywhere in the world, in every city in the world, there's someone else doing this. And that wider, broader network is really an incredible feeling.
What do you see among the young people your age, you know, who you talk to for your job in terms of what they want out of Jewish life and how ritual fits into that?
So I see the need to, it's again back to that community piece, to really connect to community and to connect to people, especially in times of struggle or change. There's a need to go back to your roots and resources that you know exist for yourself and you, what you know is true to yourself. In terms of ritual, I think that a lot of young adults try to add little things. Like I know people who, no matter what they do Friday night before they leave the house, they light Shabbat candles. That, you know, they, instead of celebrating all of the major holidays, they pick one that they truly love and really focus on that, even if it's a smaller holiday.
Such as, give an example.
So a bigger holiday, I'm talking about like Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, it's the Jewish New Year and the Jewish Day of Atonement. But someone else might really want to focus on, I'm trying to think of a good small one, like so on Sukkot, which is a harvest festival. And they might build a sukkah, which is a three-walled structure in their backyard and put palm fronds on the roof. And that's what, and you know, and they live in it. You can live in it for a week. And it's a seven-day holiday. And so some people really choose to focus on that as opposed to these larger, more holy days.
It's funny you should mention Sukkot. That's one of my favorite holidays. And I also really like Purim. And Purim is a holiday that's in like February, March. Mm-hmm. And I always think, why hasn't Purim taken off the way Mardi Gras has? Because in spirit, they are very similar holidays.
Yeah. So it's funny that you mentioned that. Why hasn't it taken off like Mardi Gras? So the idea of Purim, it actually says to drink until you don't know the difference between good and bad.
Yeah, and your enemies versus your friends.
Your enemies versus your friends. And it's a great story. And it's, it's a traditional story of good and evil, of persecution and perseverance. And actually, at the home congregation that I grew up at, we do Jello shots. And the funniest thing is my mom's the one who makes them. So my entire childhood, the month of April was dedicated to making thousands of Jello shots for our entire congregation. And I never even thought of that as part of ritual, but it really is. And, what comes out of it is really amazing.
I liked what you said about just the idea that when you're observing Shabbat, that you think about that people all over the world are doing this, that people in generations before you were doing it, that it's just there, that there are these specific behaviors that are being carried out, not just by you, but by huge numbers of people through space and time. If people aren't getting that from a faith community, the way that their parents and grandparents did, where do you think in your generation they are getting that connection to something that connects people or that's awe-inspiring or larger than themselves?
Well, I think in this political climate, I don't mean to bring this up and I don't want to get into politics, but, you know, seeing all of these grassroots organizations that are coming together to make their voice heard, I think that is a beautiful way of connecting to people. I mean, these organizations are really inspiring to people of our generation. And I think that's a really great place to connect. It's politics. It might not be multi-generational in terms of history, but, well, actually, no, I take that back. It really is. When you look at the civil rights movement, I think what's going on right now, you know, it really connects back. It harkens back to that time. And so I guess that's a really great way for millennials to connect.
Molly Hess, hang on with me. I want to talk to Helen Stringer about this. Helen is with us from KC Oasis, which is like a church, only the congregants don't necessarily ascribe to any religion and don't necessarily believe in God. Helen, can you explain that?
Yes, I'd like to describe it that we are an alternative to faith-based community. There's something really unique that religious communities can provide. And as a secular person, we have found a way to provide that unique multi-generational type of community, but in a completely secular way.
So give me an example of something that people would come to KC Oasis to do, if not to do the things you would normally associate with religion, like praying.
Well, we offer a Sunday program where one of our values is that reality is known through reason and that people are more important than beliefs. And so we do have a Sunday program every week, and we have something like a TED Talk And then offer something also described as like a house concert. So we'll bring in different musicians from all over the city. Throughout the week, we do social things together and we give back to the community at large. So there's really similar aspects, but we've removed the dogma and occasionally the exclusion that comes along with dogmatic ideas.
What do you think, I mean, do young people, do what you would call millennials, make up a lot of your, do you call it a congregation?
Group members. It's, you know, as we are so new into this, I like to call it this giant human experiment that happens to be working out really well. But we do have a fair share of millennials. We have a fair share of families and of older adults. It's somehow evolved into a multi-generational kind of setting, which was definitely part of what we wanted to see, but didn't know if that would actually carry out.
What do you think is going on right now socially in our community that's created a need for something like essentially a church without religion?
Well, if you think about it, the fastest growing religious affiliation, and I use that term loosely, but that's how they define it, is the unaffiliated or the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S's. And so it's a rapidly growing identification that a lot of us are not necessarily religious or would identify, you know, that they believe in religious tenets. We still see the value in having that type of community support. We know better than ever that having a social support network, which is usually you find in your church, congregation, or religious tradition, is just as good for your health as all the other good habits you're supposed to do and eat well, exercise, you know, don't drink as much, things like that.
Unless it's a Jell-O shot,
unless
it's part
well,
of a holiday.
I think the whole, especially she said the Jell-O shot thing. I'm like, that's a ritual I can get behind. That sounds amazing. But I think that culture is shifting. We're at this really significant cultural shift. And so we're able to provide another opportunity for people to connect and get to know one another, learn great things, you know, find that type of social support to celebrate life when it's really incredible and then to be there for each other when it's absolutely horrific.
So to celebrate life when it's incredible and to be there for each other when life, when things are horrific, mm-hmm. you know, you are describing to me what the role of a ritual within a religious community.
Yes.
Like when something's wonderful, we know how to celebrate that because people have been carrying out these same patterns to separate this wonderful moment from, not that ordinary life isn't wonderful, but to lift it up above the ordinary, or that there's something horrible that's happened and we know how to be there for each other because there's a specific thing that we do in this situation. That's ritual in some ways to me.
Sure.
How in a group that doesn't have that shared text or shared history, how do you do that?
We get to be creative in how that is. So it can look a lot like past religious traditions. It gets to be individualized in that way. So we're not restricted by, well, this is the way it's always been done, you know? That's the one freedom we have being so early on. Now, I think in like 100 years, it could become a little more rigid because that's kind of what humans do. But I think rituals evolve organically. So for example, our sister organization, Houston Oasis, they had one of the members had a child. And they were going to recognize and celebrate this new life. And the executive director was up with the father and they were like, oh, wait a minute. What are we going to do? Like, what are we going to say? They didn't plan it. And so the father's like, do I do Lion King? No, I'll just do Lion King. And so he holds the baby up like Lion King style and everyone kind of laughs. And then the next time they had another child to be dedicated or not dedicated, but recognized and celebrated, the sound team had the music cued and ready to go. And so they played the Lion King song and held up the kiddo, and that's become like kind of a funny new random ritual that evolved totally organically, but as a way to kind of recognize and celebrate a new life. So that's kind of how we're doing things.
It's time for a break, but when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a young man who converted to Catholicism. He loves Latin Mass in particular. We'll hear what he has to say about ritual in a minute, plus a historian weighs in and puts it in context. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about the role of religious ritual in the lives of millennials. I'm Gina Kaufman. So far, I've been chatting with Molly Hess, the millennial concierge for Tribe KC, and Helen Stringer of KC Oasis, an organization with what you might call the trappings of a church. It's secular, though. Hi again, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I want to talk now to Chris Cantwell about what we've been discussing so far. He's here from the UMKC History Department as well as the Religious Studies Department. Good morning, Chris.
Morning.
So when you look at young Americans overall, do you hear in what Molly and Helen have been saying, do you hear anything that fits into a bigger picture that you want to draw our attention to?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things we can talk about in terms of sort of what's new in this moment and what is sort of reflective of sort of larger cultural trends in American religion. You know, it's certainly unprecedented, as sort of Helen alluded to, that, you know, the fastest growing religious group in America right now are the non-religious, where the figures were at one point about 9% in the 1990s. It's now reported that about a quarter of Americans identify with no religious faith. And when you sort of dive down into the numbers amongst millennials, that number is even higher. That's about 4 to 10. So that's new and that's unprecedented in certain ways. But at the same time, when we talk about sort of the creative rituals like, you know, the Lion King in a secular humanist church, you know, the concern for the young has often been one of the most driving forces of creativity in American religious past, right? So in the colonial era, sort of the first sort of crack in Calvinist theology was the concern of whether young people were going to be able to join Puritan churches because they weren't as religious as their adults. In the 19th century, the concern for how young people were going to fit into a diverse multicultural environment led to the growth of Sunday schools and Catholic parochial schools and Hebrew schools. And then in the 20th century, actually, it was concern about when people tended to convert to a certain religious faith is what led to sort of the creation of the category of the adolescent, that sort of social psychologists found that it was this kind of, you know, religious sweet spot between 12 and 15 when people tended to convert. So there's always been a relationship between, you know, religious creativity and concern for the young.
You know, what I guess I'm curious about, what are some of the more interesting trends to you with respect to young Americans and religion right now?
At this moment?
Yeah.
I mean, I think what's fascinating is, and again, I think, you know, Helen's kind of a scholar of religion over there because she really put her fingers on a lot of this. She calls it sort of a cultural shift. And I see it as sort of a grand cultural transformation, that the rise of sort of the non-religious is a part and parcel of a broader change in the lack of trust in institutions generally, right? So this is a moment in which, I mean, the last election in certain ways was all about a repudiation of the grand institutions that have so far governed this country. You know, civic institutions, media institutions, and the rise of the nuns are signaling a lack of trust in these religious institutions. And while, you know, the social surveys that look at this identify them as unaffiliated, but I think that term is actually part of the problem sometimes, that we often conceive of religion as solely what institution we're a part of, right? Whereas if you look at sort of the religious lives of sort of millennials, religiosity is live and well, right? I mean, if we think about rituals as being, you know, cultural practices with a certain degree of performance that provide community and anchor our identities, I mean, I think we can look at something like Comic-Con, which is sort of a development over the last 20 years, and see sort of themes of religious belonging.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here because we may have some listeners who have not been to Comic-Con who don't know what it is, and I'm going to need you to explain it.
Oh, sure. Well, I haven't been to Comic-Con either, but it is sort of the development in the last 10, 20 years of these sort of annual conferences devoted to celebrating comic book culture and really kind of creative sci-fi, zombie world culture in general. And where at one point, I think, where people would find that kind of sense of community and belonging in religious institutions, I think we're seeing young people find that sense of belonging and finding these kind of grand moral dramas in popular culture now, right? I mean, the example I often get, I actually lecture on this in my religious history class. We talk about The Walking Dead, which is often a show about the undead, right? Or it's even conceived as sort of an anti-religious show. But if you look at sort of the central themes of that show, it's about how a man, Rick Grimes, is determining how to raise his son in a broken world. That's not a zombie theme. That is a religious theme, right? And it's a very Protestant theme as well. So whereas the church often became a source of these dramas, these grand moral dramas, we now find them in popular culture.
Is there anything, I mean, when I think about popular culture as what unites communities, I think there can be a lot of beautiful potential in that, but there's also something, I don't know, I don't think of pop culture as having that timelessness.
Well, I mean, that's certainly part of the definition of pop culture, is that it's new, right? But I think this is a part of the uniqueness of this moment, that the boundaries between the religious, the secular, the sacred and the secular are slipping, right? because these institutions that have so long been the source of religion are no longer considered to be the sole source of authority on religion, we're finding religious community, religious themes, and religious identities showing up in a variety of different ways. I mean, I think you're right. I'm not claiming that The Walking Dead is a religion, right? We need more time to see if there's the commissioning of priests and the creation of congregational communities. But I think part of what animates the popularity of some of these shows and conventions and community groups is this need for community and identity.
Well, so if you're talking about that, part of what's going on in religion right now among younger people is a distrust in an institution that you can see beyond religion in our culture. But would that account for some of the high degree of personalization of ritual that, you know, we've heard Molly talk about the Shabbat in her house, mm-hmm. where it's less synagogue centric and more centered in her home and about who she invites, and that those people may be Jewish, may not be.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think we see this as a broader part of millennial culture in general, that there's an appreciation for sort of artisanal goods as opposed to buying them at big box stores. And that sort of return to finding community locally, I think, is a central part of this. You know, I think Helen's the broader network of Oasis is really illustrative here, that it's not a denomination, right? It is a series of locations that have chosen to meet where they're at. As far as I know, there's no grand Oasis denomination issuing statements of faith, right? It's about the people who are in a certain place at a certain time determining what works best for them. And that sort of hyper-individualism, I think, is a part of what's at work here at this moment.
What's your own relationship with religion and faith, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah. So I was raised in sort of a Southern Baptist church, which is one of the largest and most conservative Protestant denominations. And I mean, it's interesting when you talk about sort of the relationship between religion and youth, because as I sort of grew up, I came aware that the broader denomination of which I was a part sort of espoused all these political views, which I did not personally share at all. But at the same time, my local congregation was the center of my social cultural world. And still to this day, you know, some of my best friends that I still keep in touch with came out of that congregation. But I can tell you across the board, none of us are in church anymore. And I think it sort of speaks to why there is this upsurge in the nuns, because
and
many...
that's N-O-N-E.
Yes,
not
sorry,
N-U-N.
The N-O-N-E-S, the unaffiliated, as the Pew Research Forum likes to call them, because they're just hoping they'll affiliate soon. Is part of it is a certain sort of, you know, burnout in that these broader religious institutions we were a part of were also sort of implicitly political, and as our own sort of political views and lives changed, you know, we have to figure out where our religious beliefs line up with those political beliefs, and I think a lot of us are still figuring that out.
What's the role of ritual in all of that for you? I mean, are there rituals that you lost touch with as a part of distancing yourself from a church, or do you carry out ritual in some other way?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some sense, it depends on what we mean by ritual. So if we understand ritual to be a highly stylized performance in a sequestered place like a congregation, then I'm not necessarily ritualistic, right? But I still keep part of sort of, we understand ritual as the performance of grand traditions. Then rituals actually continue to be very important to me and my household. So, you know, we're looking forward to celebrate Christmas coming up, and we'll tell our children the story of Christmas and what it means and what we draw from it. But then, you know, we're still looking for that home of a broader network of where that connects to.
Do people need ritual?
You know, it's funny. I'm trying to think about how to answer this as an academic and answer it as a person, right? You know, I think ritual in some ways is unavoidable in that because the human need for community and the human need to sort of, I think, as Molly was referencing, to figuring out, you know, who I am and where I came from, that is what ritual provides. And if we don't do it in a formal setting, we're recognizing that it is ritual. I think these rituals tend to develop organically. And this is why, like I say, I can look at Comic-Con and see it as a kind of ritual. I can look at sports events and see them as kind of rituals where we're trying to determine who we are and where we belong.
And what team we're on.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Well, let's hear a different perspective. I want to talk with Joseph Gilligan. He works in our building. He does custodial services for KCUR, and his relationship with Catholicism is really interesting to me. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
How old are you?
31.
So you, if I understand it right, you grew up Lutheran but converted to Catholicism and now regularly attend Latin Mass.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to Catholicism?
I think when I went to college, it was a lot of church shopping because the Lutheran church I tried to go to was, I don't know, kind of big and bland and typical. And there was a lot of churches that in the historical part of Duluth where I went to school, I saw on my bus route and was intrigued by. And they all had kind of similar stories, you know, coffee and donuts and visiting and excited to see me or whatever. But the Catholics had a certain conviction because, like, you couldn't even go to communion as a Protestant. They had this, like, dividing line between me and them and volumes of books in their bookstore that illustrated their different beliefs and doctrines and stuff. And I guess that conviction contrasted my upbringing because we were Lutheran, but we were really just Christian and happened to be Lutheran. And through, you know, reading.
Wait,
and
I want you to unpack that a little bit, because when you say you just happened to be Lutheran, I mean, are you saying that it didn't feel like there was a strong sense of identity with it?
Almost. When things were specifically Lutheran, it was almost like an offhanded mention, like, well, as good Lutherans, we're supposed to believe, you know, that we'll rise to the East or whatever. And it was, so it was kind of like an afterthought. And, you know, we had our little Lutheran catechisms and stuff, and they all said Luther all over them, but we didn't really understand why that made us right or somebody else wrong, and that wasn't really the emphasis at all. And I guess that lack of conviction and then that contrasting when I met with the Catholics was intriguing.
What do rituals mean to you? Because, you know, choosing to attend specifically a Latin Mass is, yeah, it seems very grounded in an idea of ritual. I'm guessing you don't normally speak Latin.
Right. No, I don't. The Catholics' heaviness on ritual kind of did a really good job at illustrating a lot of those beliefs that I ended up digging up in all these books, and the Mass especially. All these parts of the Mass and the prayers and all these different things had meaning behind them and illustrated those various doctrines that I had wrapped my mind around and come to peace with or had come to believe. And so, and then all the feast days and the various, you know, different even rituals at home that we do all kind of exemplify that I do believe these things or that this community believes these things, that they're not just, yeah.
So the ritual really ties back to belief for you. Does it also fill another role in your life when you think about your life just more holistically?
I don't, maybe.
Not sure.
Yeah, I don't know the question really.
Well, do you think like, do you think that the other parts of yourself, the, I mean, and maybe that's not a fair question. I mean, for me, I guess there are parts of myself that have to do with my spiritual belief system or whatever. And then there are parts of myself that are maybe my emotions or yeah, my family relationships, things like that. And religion touches on all of those different things. And so I guess there are aspects of when I'm participating in a ritual that might have more to do with the connection to family or with the an emotional need than at any given moment, possibly with what's going on with me spiritually.
Sure. Well, there is a certain amount with each of our various different rituals, you know, going to confession or Mass or whatever, that has emotional or family connections. You know, we say the rosary every night, and that's something that no matter what, we're going to come together and do as a family, and has that aspect. If you're tired and you just want to go to bed or eat something and you're going to have to say the rosary first, there's another level to it then, because you're not connecting necessarily on a spiritual or religious level, but you're still coming together as a family for that moment.
I'm looking around the room and seeing that some of our other guests have just started taking notes, which leads me to believe that they might have something to say about what they just heard from Joe. So, Molly, would you care to jump in?
Oh, I just love that you say no matter what, you say the rosary every night. So for my family, when we were kids, it's just no matter what, you go to family dinner. And growing up, we had family dinner every single night. And if we were running to hockey practice or dance lessons or whatever, if it meant having family dinner on the road, we sat down at a restaurant and had fast food together. But I just love that there is still that tradition in your home. And I think that's a really beautiful ritual to have.
Do you think that that's something that people maybe feel an absence of and crave?
You know, I do, but I also don't exactly have a family yet. So we're not quite there. And I don't have an equivalent of the rosary for myself. But I think that there is a need for structure. And I think that millennials do crave structure in their lives in some ways, as crazy as we are as of a generation. Yeah.
Helen, what about you?
What I keep hearing is that, rituals are a part of human nature. Molly, my family too met, we had dinner every night, and that was wonderful, and we loved that. I think it's something that's built into our very beings. And I don't think it's always this extravagant, rich robes, candles, and the ceremonial thing. I like to think my morning cup of coffee is a ritual that I love. I look forward to it every day. But it is kind of a form of a ritual in the same way, but as an individual. And we have family rituals. We have group rituals. And it's part of being a human being. And so when I hear everyone kind of talk about it, I think it's kind of finding what that looks like now in today's culture that looks different than maybe it did, 100, thousands, 2,000 years ago, where a lot of these initially evolved. But I think our brains like that. Our brains like habit. They like patterns. So, doing something every night is, neurologically, very satisfying. So that's just kind of what I was sitting here thinking more about.
Joe, do you feel like you fit into the bigger story you're hearing everyone else telling right now, or do you feel a little like an odd man out?
A little odd man out. I mean, not 100%. I understand where you guys are coming from and what you're saying, but my experience in college was, it was isolated because very quickly I kind of zoned in on hanging out with the Catholic kids. But we were all people who had been raised less religiously and had in college found ritual and religion and even doctrine interesting and exciting. And so all the younger people that I was around, and it's isolated people, but were doing kind of the opposite and were contrasting their parents and becoming more religious and more into that. And so.
And that ritual then for you, it was so much, it sounds like, about reaffirming who you were choosing to be.
Right.
Chris, help us put these things together as part of two phenomena that might seem like opposites, but that characterize one generation of people.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What I heard Joe talking about is when you dive down into the numbers of the growing portion of the population that identifies as religiously unaffiliated, when you ask them, like, well, why did you choose to unaffiliate? About 80% of them, so this is the overwhelming majority of reasons, say, well, I just don't believe this anymore. Like, I don't believe this. And I think what that reveals is that in sort of popular understandings of religion, religion is often identified as a belief, right? It's a series of propositions that you either agree with or disagree with. And that is a very narrow definition of religion, whereas what I think our three other panelists are talking about today is that there is a need and a crave to have these sort of cultural practices, these communal practices that are sort of not burdened by their belief or whether or not they're true. And I think, in many ways, ritual sort of frees you from the burden of believing because you can do it, whether or not where you stand.
Chris Cantwell, Joe Gilligan, Molly Hess, and Helen Stringer, thank you all so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, an art exhibit called Que Pasa USA, artists of color from across the U.S. approach questions of race and belonging with humor. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by Lynette Miranda. She's the curator of an art exhibit called Que Pasa USA. Hi, Lynette.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Explain the title of this show.
Sure. The title of the exhibition is actually taken from a sitcom that aired on PBS in the late 70s of the same name. And it was a sitcom of a three-generation family in Miami, all Cuban-American. And so it's the first bilingual sitcom in the United States. So it takes inspiration from that kind of immigrant experience, but through a lens of humor, which is the premise of the exhibition.
Why Why humor? Why was that important to you as you approached the idea of putting together a national group show? I mean, a huge undertaking. Why was the humor and kind of lightheartedness of the approach, why was that important to you?
So the exhibition, Que Pasa USA, is a 11 artists group exhibition from artists from New York, Chicago, Miami, and Kansas City. And the concept of the exhibition is really to think about identity and what it means to be a citizen today through the lens of identity. And the idea for me really manifested in May once I received the date of my first exhibition, and that would be...
So you're the curator in residence for the Charlotte Street Foundation.
Yeah, correct.
And so in that role, your first exhibition.
Yeah, so it's my first exhibition, and I received the date of the exhibition, and it was going to be on November 18th, and it kind of intimidated me because I knew it was going to be a week after the presidential election, and the way that I work in general is very connected to the things happening in the world. And I couldn't curate an exhibition that would seem like it existed just in a vacuum. And so I thought about what I felt the tension of the election would be by the time that the election rolled around, not knowing anything in terms of, like, you know, I can't tell the future. And so, but I knew that it was already very tense and contentious, especially for me as a woman of color, a Latina woman. I felt that it was really important to think about creating a space that would allow for people to sort of think about what's happening in our country through a different way, right? Not just kind of a strictly critical way, but open it up for people to come and sort of release and think about not just humor, but joy, and think about humor and joy as an act of resistance, and also taking back the narrative of these artists of color. They're taking back the dominant narrative of their experience and not just looking at it through their way of... through tragedy. Or
can you tell me more about joy as an act of resistance?
Sure. There are two artists specifically in this exhibition, Damali Abrams, based in New York City, and Jackie Carmen Guerrero, who's based in Chicago. They're both of Afro-Caribbean descent, and they approach their practice and the work in the exhibition through thinking about, for Damali specifically, thinking about the Black experience and the Black body through the lens of joy and happiness and celebration. And she takes a lot of, folklore from, she's Guyanese, so folklore from, like, the Caribbean and mermaids, and takes popular culture and popular culture icons and sort of juxtaposes those things to really think about shifting that narrative, not just from, like I said, tragedy, but also reclaiming the existence of a person of color through a different lens. And a lot of the show and a lot of these artists have to think about these things as modes of self-preservation because, you know, this show is all people of color, but typically the art world is predominantly white, and so they tend to be tokenized or tend to be one of a few artists in a group exhibition.
So it sounds like, I mean, I want to think more, I mean, the idea of joy as an act of resistance, I think, is a really beautiful concept, especially if you're in a position of feeling oppressed or threatened. The idea that you get up and you find something joyful, that is rebellious. I really love that idea. And I wonder how that fits into your own story and your own background. Is that something you have experience with?
I mean, I think that for me personally, I think about self-care as a very important part of my practice, because without self-care, or without thinking about how I self-preserve, I can't keep doing the work that I do. And a lot of the work that I do as a quote-unquote curator is really about taking the power that I'm given and redistributing it to the artists and the audiences that I'm addressing. And sometimes in some situations, not in the case for this exhibition, but that means really challenging systems of power within the art world.
Tell me about yourself and your upbringing and what you bring to this conversation. Because you're the sort of invisible piece of the exhibition. You know what I mean? There's you, from the artists, you see what they've created. And you're doing something a little bit, your role is a little subtler for people who walk in there.
Yeah. So a little bit about myself. I'm originally from Miami, Florida. I am first-generation American. My family's from Peru. I went to art school in Chicago, went to grad school at NYU. And sort of early on in high school, art just kind of spoke to me, but not because of it was not because it was a mode of expression, but because it was an avenue and a vehicle for critical thinking. And so somewhere along the line, without getting fully into every single thing that I've done, I realized that I was really great at working with people and working with artists and working within institutions. And I started to work in museums and noticed that, you know, both how audiences and artists were both talked about internally was so far removed. And it just kind of ignited my interest in working on the inside and sort of coordinating.
So like that artists living in your community weren't really connected to what was happening inside museums, for example.
Yeah, museums or other nonprofit institutions. And I think there's like a lot of assumptions in terms of what artists need and artistic practices, but also the institution works as this mediator between artists and audience that I think sometimes is really frustrating for me and was very frustrating for me when I was much younger. And so I am also an educator, an art educator, and I teach at the Kansas City Art Institute. And I think that connecting, you know, artists and their ideas and the complexity of the kinds of ways that they think is so important to connect that with a broader general non-art audience. And I think institutions often mediate that way too much without really intending to, but just by default kind of create a limit to how people can access art.
So if I were wanting to access the art in the current exhibition, Que Pasa USA, could you describe for me something that you think really exemplifies the use of humor as a form of rebellion or just a different way of approaching a conversation that maybe we've all heard so much in a similarly serious tone that the humor just brings freshness?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the artists use humor in such a didactic way. One artist that sticks out is Enzo Mascarella, who is based in New York, and he designed and installed three ephemeral floor drawings based on sort of mandala drawings made out of rice and beans, where he took he takes icons, and in this case he took the Don't Tread on Me Gazdin flag snake and paired it with a smiley face sort of graphic image similar to sort of maybe the smiley face we see on thank you bags. And he made these 8-foot floor drawings out of rice and beans. And during the opening, the amount of people that didn't realize it wasn't a rug because it looks so sort of perfect and sort of stepped on this sort of this don't tread on me icon, reconstructed and appropriated icon. A lot of Enzo's work is thinking about symbols that get reappropriated, and that one specifically has been appropriated and reappropriated at different moments in time.
What do you think, I mean, can you spell out a little bit what you think the rice and beans are about as a material, a choice of material?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that Enzo specifically thinks about materials in a way that he's challenging cultural assumptions. So for some, we can just read them as rice and beans and grains. But for others, you might associate that with Mexican culture or any kind of like South American or Latin American or Central American culture. So it's really what I really enjoy about Enzo's work and the way that he creates access is that he takes all of these things. He takes icons, he takes material, and he sort of puts it together. And rather than telling you, you know, or describing or presenting something that's humorous, he's actually creating multiple access points for people to find the humor within the work.
What's funny about it to you?
Oh, for me, the funniest part is having a lot of privileged art people step on it during the opening and not seeing it, not even like acknowledging it, even though they're pretty large and they're pretty obvious. So I think that it adds sort of meaning to the work, because in previous iterations he's done other kinds of symbols. People haven't stepped on it before, and it's sort of there's no barrier, so you sort of just view it from standing over it. And so this was really interesting to me that this is the first time for him. He was here for the opening. It's the first time he saw people step on it. And it wasn't just one or two people accidentally. It was like a lot of people. And I think that adds an extra layer of meaning for me that is humorous but is really telling.
Telling of what?
I think telling of the fact that we're not as self-aware as we may think we are, especially like art audiences do tend to be, they're more critical and aware of the things happening. And it was interesting to see how sort of self-involved people were and didn't notice the art on the floor.
Do you think, when you talk about art audiences and you say something like privileged art people, where does that feeling that you have about who makes up this community by and large, where do you think, can you tell me more about that feeling?
Sure. I mean, I'm a privileged art person. I went to art school and I went to grad school, and I have a level of education that makes me privileged. So I wouldn't take myself out of that equation at all. I just think that it is, you know, I've worked at many art institutions across different large cities, and the audience tends to be the same. People involved in the arts coming to art openings or art exhibitions. And so I'm really trying to figure out and think about expanding that audience in whatever way. But obviously I'm one person, and I don't have a whole team of people that can, an outreach coordinator or a community organizer to do that work. But by being reflexive within my own practices and understanding what audience I do have and what audience I want to build, that's really important to me. So when I say privileged art audience, I'm including myself and a lot of the colleagues that I respect tremendously. But, you know, we are privileged in this way where we have education and we have access to things that many others maybe don't have access to, and understand the context of contemporary art.
And this exhibition, I mean, one of the things I am excited about with it is the role of humor. Something that I've thought about is, do you think there's something about today, like who in our culture feels comfortable and safe enough to make a joke, potentially even at their own expense?
I think that's a tough question. I don't know. I think that maybe the way that we're thinking about humor is too straight on. I personally think that humor is a way in which we can critique maybe systems that exist and a way to create that access. And it's so much more complex than just being funny, but it's being critical.
Lynette Miranda, curator of Que Pasa USA, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That exhibit, which includes work by artists from all over the country, including Kansas City, is on view at La Esquina through January 7th. And that's a wrap for today's show, but you can listen to either of today's conversations later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can keep talking to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about cookies because they're delicious, and we don't need more of a reason than that. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stick around.